You may be seated. My name is Scott Grant. I'm one of the pastors and elders and preachers here. May I extend my welcome to the Stanford students who are with us this morning as well. Usually we have a collection of Santa Clara University students with us for this service, but most of them are away to retreat this weekend. So come back again. You'll meet some more students from another university. So last week, I wasn't here. I was with many of you at the Fall Retreat, which is our retreat once a year that's open to everyone. And it was a marvelous time together. And especially I appreciated Sunday morning when many of the people shared from their hearts about what they had experienced, not only that weekend, but what they have experienced of God in this community. And especially the emphasis was on this multi-generational community that God has gathered here. And so it was really great to hear how God was moving among people to recognize that and appreciate that. The highlight for me every year at the Fall Retreat is when I do the baptisms. Now, I'm the pastor in charge of the Fall Retreat, but in truth, don't tell anybody else this, I have very little to do. I have no responsibility, almost none. That's because of what Steve mentioned earlier, our value here on what we call the ministry of the saints, meaning that everyone here is gifted, and we have this remarkable team that puts this thing together every year. So the only thing that I have to do is baptize people. But it's really this amazing experience for me every year when I am baptizing folks. I'm standing next to the pool at Mission Springs, and I'm looking at these people that I'm about to baptize, and I'm talking about baptism, I'm talking about Christ, and I'm talking about this community. And most of the people who get baptized at this retreat are young people who have grown up here and seen these baptisms through the years. And so I think about all of that, and I think about the story of baptism and all of what it means, and I think about these young people. And it just all converges in my heart as I'm standing poolside. And those of you who go to the retreat each year, what happens at that point? I cry. That's right. I lose it. It's just all, something just explodes in my heart right before I'm going to baptize all these people. Somehow I hold it together while we're doing the baptism, but just when I'm talking about it, I tend to lose it. Something explodes in my heart. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is after our hearts. He's after your heart. He's after my heart. That's why he gives us the Sermon on the Mount. That's why he begins with the Beatitudes. Blessed are, blessed are, blessed are. He wants to go to our hearts so that we can ultimately respond to the Lord from our hearts. Now, how do we understand the word heart? Now, sort of in our culture, the word heart means only emotions. But biblically speaking, the word heart includes the emotions. It also includes the intellect. It also includes the will. But really, at the deepest level, when you think about it, and when you analyze it, technical definitions only go so far. And the heart, in reality, holds our sorrows and our longings. It's the place of our sorrows and longings. And Jesus wants to capture those. He wants to capture our hearts. And with his words today in the Sermon on the Mount concerning lust, he wants to capture our hearts. So let's look at the text again and see if we can understand what Jesus is speaking to us. Matthew 5, 27 and 28. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Okay, that's easily understandable. Let's just go to the next passage, okay? Let's just, and that's on marriage and, oh no, that's on marriage and divorce. Oh, we don't want to do that one either. So I guess we've got to deal with this. So we're going to talk about what adultery of the heart is all about. So what is Jesus doing here? He's doing the same thing that he did with the prohibition against murder. He goes beneath the commandment. He went beneath the commandment concerning murder and found anger. Now he goes beneath the commandment concerning adultery and finds something that we might call adultery of the heart. Now this word that is translated lustful is actually a verb. The ESV is trying to put the whole thing together, and it's a good translation, but really the word means basically to intensely desire, to intensely desire. So now we have to understand, first of all, that God created us as creatures of desire. We desire. We want. Basically, human desire is good. God created us that way. He created us to desire good things. Ultimately, he created us to desire him. So we are creatures of desire. Jesus uses this exact same verb in Luke chapter 22, verse 15, when he's talking about sharing the Passover with his disciples. And he says, I have earnestly desired to share this Passover meal with you. I have intensely desired to share this Passover meal. Now, of course, we wouldn't say that's a bad desire. That's a good desire. Jesus, of course, desires something. He desires something good, to share the Passover meal with his disciples. Now let's talk about our sexual desires. God created us as sexual beings. God created us with good sexual desires. It is good that we have been created as sexual beings. God thought about it. God did it. God created us with these intense sexual desires, which create some problems for us, but we have to begin by understanding that this is how God created us, and God created us with these good desires. Now, of course, it is quite possible to have whatever desires we have and to spend them wrongly, to desire wrong things. Pascal says this, human beings are peculiar in that they pursue ends they know will bring them no satisfaction, gorge themselves with food that cannot nourish, and with pleasures that cannot please. So it is quite possible to take your desires, including your sexual desires, and want something that is wrong, that is actually destructive for you and destructive for other people as well. So Jesus would have us guard against that. James here is very helpful in his epistle in James chapter 1, verses 14 and 15, to help us understand what happens with desire. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. So, seeing is not wrong. Desiring is not wrong. Temptation is not wrong, though of course we should not seek out temptation. But what happens? Desire welcomes temptation, nurses temptation, chooses temptation, and then desire and temptation give birth to sin. That's what James is saying. It's a mouthful, so let me say it again. Desire welcomes temptation, nurses temptation, chooses temptation, and then desire and temptation give birth to sin. That's from James. Also relating to Matthew 5:28. Now, let's return to Matthew 5:28 and see if we can understand what Jesus is talking about. Now, this is my translation of Matthew chapter 5, verse 28, a literal translation. When I'm preaching from the New Testament, I go through the Greek, which was the language that the New Testament was written in. I do my own translation in order for me to get as close as I can to the biblical text. And so this is my literal translation. So usually here we preach out of the English Standard Version or the ESV. This is the Scott Grant version or the SGV. Okay, one verse here. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman in order to intensely desire her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So what's the problem here? The problem is intentional looking for the purpose of intensely desiring another man's wife. So on the face of it, that's what Jesus is saying. But we certainly would not think of Jesus here condoning a woman's doing the same thing. No, of course he would say, if a woman's got this problem, a woman has a problem as well. So we can't limit it to simply men, and nor can we limit it to simply adultery. We can't imagine Jesus, based on Matthew 5:28, condoning other forms of non-marital sex in terms of the fantasy life and everything that goes with it, the coveting and the desiring of someone else's spouse. Now, we would extend this, I think, to the whole fantasy life. So if you are indulging in all of these fantasies concerning someone who is not your spouse, you are nursing them, you're having these desires, and you are nursing the desires and spending effort on them and being very intentional about all of that, we can't imagine Jesus, I think, condoning such sexual fantasies. Neither can we imagine him condoning the use of pornography, because pornography goes hand in hand with sexual fantasies. So that's my understanding of it. Now, what happens when we indulge in this kind of thing? Well, in reality, we are dehumanizing the person. There is some person that we are desiring, there's some person we're thinking about, and we are dehumanizing that person. We are turning that person into an object, and that person then exists as an object, not as a person, to satisfy our own desires. That is dehumanizing someone. And Jesus, of course, doesn't want us to do that. He wants to honor everyone and recognize that everyone has been created in the image of God. So, sexual desires obviously can be wrongfully directed. And then we have what we might call adultery of the heart. But let's be absolutely clear about one thing. Actual adultery is worse. It results in far worse consequences, and the results are often devastating for people and for families. Nevertheless, Jesus is going underneath the commandment in order to understand where it all begins. It all begins in the human heart, the place of our sorrows and longings. Okay, so what do we do then in the face of temptation? And we all, to one degree or another, deal with sexual temptation to take these good desires that God has given us and to wrongfully direct them. Now it gets really interesting. Verses 29 and 30. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell. Now, work with me on this for a little bit. And what would it be like if we were to take Jesus literally here? Okay, if your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out. So I have to, first of all, take off my glasses. My right eye now has caused me to sin. I have to tear it out. I can't do it. I cannot tear out my eye. Jesus doesn't say, go hire a surgeon. He says, you tear out your eye. Well, Jesus, I can't do it. What, should I grow my fingernails long, sharpen them up, and then start, whittling away? And I'll get a little deeper. I still don't think I'm going to be able to do it. Even if I were able to do it, it is not enough, according to Jesus, for me to remove my eye. I have to tear it out, and I have to throw it away. But if I were able to actually remove my eye, I would be in so much pain, writhing on the ground, I wouldn't have the wherewithal to take my eye and to throw it away. And by the way, let me put my glasses back on so I can actually see. By the way, how is it that only my right eye and not my left eye causes me to sin? Is my left eye closed at the time? Or am I just like a little sideways here and I just can only see out of my right eye? It's absolutely absurd. Every word speaks of absurdity. Now my right hand has caused me to sin. What do I need to do? I need to cut it off. Now, I got a better chance at cutting off my right hand than I do at tearing out my right eye, but I'm right-handed, and I've got a left hand here. I got to get a real heavy cleaver. I mean, really. And then with all my might, I've got to hack away. And my guess is that one hack isn't going to do it. I'm going to have to keep hacking, but I'm in so much pain, how am I going to keep hacking? I can't do it. Now, assuming that I was actually able to do it, it's not enough to cut off my right hand. Jesus says, you also got to throw it away. With my good hand, I suppose. Now I throw it, but I'm on the ground, I'm writhing in pain, I'm bleeding all over the place, I need a tourniquet. Oh, Jesus said, don't worry about all that, just, take your right hand and throw it away. So if I'm going to take Jesus literally here, and assuming now that I have successfully removed my right eye, I have successfully removed my right hand, but I've still got some body parts that are having a few problems. I still have some offensive body parts, so what am I supposed to do? Keep hacking away, keep tearing away, until ultimately there's nothing left of me but a stump? Is that what I'm supposed to do? And then, assuming that I end up as a holy stump, now am I to assume that I'm now fit to go into heaven as a holy stump so that my whole body doesn't go into hell? Okay. You see where I'm going here, right? It's absurd. Jesus is being intentionally absurd. He is not speaking in order to be taken literally. You know, people will ask you all the time, oh, you don't take the Bible literally, do you? I say, sometimes I do. Sometimes I don't. It depends on what is being spoken and how it's being spoken. In this case, I don't take it literally. What is Jesus doing here? So, now, if you take it literally, some have done this historically with tragic results. Origen, an early church father, was famous for castrating himself. That's not what we want to do, folks. Don't start hacking away at body parts. How are we to understand this? The dead giveaway is in the conditional clauses. Jesus says, if your right eye causes you to sin. Well, my right eye does not cause me to sin. It is my heart that causes me to sin. Then Jesus says, if your right hand causes you to sin, my right hand does not cause me to sin. It is my heart that causes me to sin. Jesus says so in Matthew chapter 15, verse 19. For out of the heart will come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness, slander. So the heart is the problem. And you cannot tear out or cut away or throw away your heart. Okay. Where is Jesus going with this? We have to go back to Matthew chapter 5, verse 20, when Jesus said, your righteousness must exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees, meaning you have to have a goodness in your heart. That is what is better than the scribes and the Pharisees because they took a completely surface-level approach. But Jesus is saying the kingdom of heaven is here, I'm here, the Holy Spirit is coming, and there's going to be a work that's going to be done in your hearts. And that is this deep goodness in your hearts that Jesus is bringing about, as opposed to simply a surface-level approach to sin. So what could we do? And maybe what should we do? We could, if we are dealing with sexual temptation, we could build in accountability. We could modify our devices. We could take all of our devices, smash them to bits, and throw them all away. Now, such an approach is often helpful. Such an approach is often necessary. Helpful, necessary, incomplete, and insufficient, because these sorts of preventative measures do not get to the heart of the matter, which is what? Your heart. The focus of these measures is on what not to do, not on what to do. These kinds of measures do not, you know, to remove the temptation, they don't end up removing your heart. And remember, the purpose of the commandments, as Jesus gets underneath the commandments, is not to not sin. Let me say that again. The purpose of the commandments, as Jesus gets underneath the commandments, is not to not sin. The purpose of the commandments is to love. That's why Jesus gives them to us, goes underneath them, so that we will become loving people who care deeply for those around us. And as Paul says in Romans chapter 13, it is love that fulfills the law. Bill Thrall and Bruce McNichol, in this book, The Kingdom Life, say this. I discover that attempting to sin less doesn't guarantee that I will love more. But loving others will definitely result in less sinning. Try it. Try loving others more and see if it doesn't result in less sinning. So in order for the words of Jesus to actually mean something to us and to be realized in our lives, something has to happen in our hearts. And if you believe in Jesus Christ, I have good news for you, sisters and brothers. Something already has happened. Jesus says, right before the Sermon on the Mount, the kingdom of heaven is near, meaning the king is here. And the king then is going to send his Spirit. And the Spirit then is going to do a deep work in our hearts. So the kingdom of heaven is near, meaning the healing, loving power of God in the person of Christ and in the presence of the Spirit is now available to all. This was anticipated by the prophets of old. Let's look at Ezekiel. Ezekiel, a prophet from the Hebrew Scriptures, is looking forward to the time of Christ and the advent of the Spirit. And this is God speaking through the prophet Ezekiel. And I will give you a new heart and a new spirit I will put within you. And I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. I will put my Spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes and be careful to obey my rules. Key words here, heart and spirit. The Spirit does a deep work in our hearts. This was anticipated by Ezekiel. Now, Jeremiah also anticipated the same thing, and he calls it a new covenant or a new partnership between God and his people that is going to feature the Spirit. And then the writer of Hebrews then, looking back to what God said through Jeremiah, channels all of those words from God and says this in Hebrews chapter 8, verses 10 to 12. And this again is God speaking from back then, but the writer of Hebrews is saying this is happening now. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach each one his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, Know the Lord. For they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will be merciful toward their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more. Something's going to happen on their hearts, God said back in Jeremiah. The writer of Hebrews says that's happened now. It's happened already. And what is the Spirit doing? The Spirit is nothing if not relational. He is relational in a collective sense, relating us all together to God. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And he is also relational in an individual sense to draw each of us individually up into relationship with God. They shall all know me from the least to the greatest. So this has an individual sense and it also has a collective sense. So that's why it's very important that we gather here on Sunday mornings. It's very important that we do something like go away for the fall retreat and we all get together and we worship the Lord collectively. It's also important for you to have your own time with the Lord, to be drawn together, to be drawn to him in your own particular ways as you worship him. Now, in both the Hebrew Scriptures and in the New Testament, marriage illustrates God's love for us, right? So, marriage isn't the big thing. The big thing is God's marriage to us, God's covenant love for us. Marriage simply illustrates God's love for us. Therefore, the intensity of our sexual desires should remind us of the intensity of our desire for God. Whether we know that or not, it's there. We intensely desire God, and our sexual desires should remind us of that. But here's the thing. Here's what that means. If we intensely desire God, that means that he intensely desires us. We wouldn't desire him in the first place. We wouldn't even be creatures of desire, people who want, who crave, who yearn. We wouldn't even be that in the first place unless God made us that way. And that means that he desires us. So when Jesus says to his disciples, I have earnestly desired to share this Passover meal with you. Do you think it is only for 12 men that he is talking about? Think about what's going to happen at that Passover meal. He is going to break the bread. He's going to pour out the wine. And we know what that means. He actually tells us what it means. It means my body, which is broken for you. It means my blood, which is shed for you. It means he's going to the cross. It means he dies for us in his death for us. That's what the Passover means. He's thinking about us. So when he says, I desire to share this Passover meal with you, he's speaking to you. I desire to be with you. In the New Testament, Jesus is called the bridegroom. We're the bride. The bridegroom desires his bride. He desires us. Think about the person. In his room, perhaps, he's got a computer screen in front of him. He's looking at an image, or she's looking at an image. The image is looking back. But the image really isn't looking back, is it? There's a real person behind that image. And the real person is actually looking into a camera. But now the fantasy is that this person, who you don't know, actually desires you. It's an illusion. It's not real. That person is real, assuming that it's a photo image or moving image or whatever. The person is real, but the illusion that the person wants you is not real. What is real? Something that is so much better. God wants you. Jesus wants you. The Spirit is in our hearts right now to fan the flames of our desire for God so that we might sense his desire for us. God is romancing us. Listen to Brent Curtis in the book, The Sacred Romance. Indeed, if we will listen, a sacred romance calls to us through our heart every moment of our lives. It whispers to us on the wind, invites us through the laughter of good friends, reaches out to us through the touch of someone we love. We've heard it in our favorite music, sensed it at the birth of our first child, been drawn to it while watching the shimmer of a sunset on the ocean. The romance is even present in times of great personal suffering, the illness of a child, the loss of a marriage, the death of a friend. Something calls to us through these experiences like these and rouses an inconsolable longing deep within our heart, wakening in us a yearning for intimacy, beauty, and adventure. And God is calling to us through the events of our lives, every moment of the day. He is calling to us. He is romancing us. Don't try to conquer your sexual desires. Instead, recognize within your sexual desires a fierce and grave and upward-reaching yearning to lose yourself and find yourself in the paradise of God. It's one of the things your sexual desires are there for. And Jesus speaks in our passage today about what is better for you. What is better for you than the desire for adultery of the heart? It's desire for intimacy with God. Desire for intimacy with the one who created you and the one who has redeemed you. The greater desire transcends the lesser desire. You can't simply just stop doing something bad. You're going to want to do it again. You've got to start doing something good. The greater desire transcends the lesser desire. And only God can heal your sorrows and satisfy your longings. The writer of Hebrews, I referred to him earlier from Hebrews chapter 8, he speaks a lot about this new covenant, which I call a new partnership between God and us, which features the Holy Spirit. And he says, based on this new partnership, what should you do? Many times he says throughout the book, these two words, draw near. Draw near. Draw near to God in worship, in confession, in prayer, in reflection. And when you think about this, this encouragement comes to us, maybe today, especially to those of us who struggle with in the whole sexual area and are racked maybe with guilt about that and just don't feel very good about ourselves. And what does the writer of Hebrews tell us to do with that? Draw near. You think God doesn't want you because of that? That's why Jesus died, for crying out loud. Draw near. You go to a restaurant these days, you order something from the menu, then the wait person brings it to you, right? You're sitting at the table, the wait person comes, you're very excited about this, assuming that you think you ordered something good, right? And the wait person brings the plate down, sets it down right in front of you, and what does the wait person these days say, usually? Enjoy, right? Enjoy. The kingdom of heaven, brothers and sisters, is a feast. God has placed himself before us. He has placed this great adventure before us. It's so much better than our illusions. It's a feast. The kingdom of heaven is a feast. What do? You draw near to God. You enjoy. You enjoy what he has for you. You enjoy him. You enjoy the king. You enjoy the relationship you have with him. You enjoy his love for you, which cleanses you from everything that isn't good. You have to take in the wonder of it all. There was just wonder to behold every single day. Just look around you. Look at creation. Look at people. Look at the events. Feel the sensations in your life. Just take it all in. Take in the wonder. So enjoy. But to really enjoy, you kind of have to watch. You have to be attentive. Watch for what God is doing. Look at what's going on around you. Connect a few dots. Watch for what God is doing. I've found this exercise to be really helpful for me. Each morning, I try to look back on the previous day. And I think about and reflect on what happened. What was I feeling? What sensations did I have? Where was I sorrowful? Where was I joyful? Where was I just bored out of my mind? I try to look back on these things, and I ask the Lord, were you showing me anything in that? Are you drawing me to you in any way? And the answer inevitably is yes. He's always drawing me to himself. But it helps to be able to look and invite God to search your own heart and to search your own life, to pay attention to your life, to see what he's actually doing. So perhaps such an exercise would be helpful for you as well. I do it in the morning, but a lot of people do this kind of exercise in the evening, and then they look back on the day that they have just lived. So a week ago Saturday at Mission Springs, we are walking up to the pool. And there are four young women who are going to be baptized. And I'm standing poolside next to these four young women, grown up in the church, known most of them since birth. And I think about the Christ story. I think about their lives. I think about this community that has raised these precious young people. And now I think about them professing their love for Christ publicly in front of this community, and I lost it again, like I'm losing it right now. And what is God doing with me in that moment? Here's what I think. I think he's romancing me. I think he's drawing me to himself. Here's what I also think. I think he's doing the same thing with you right now. He's romancing you. Can you feel it? Can you feel maybe what God is doing in your heart? Can you feel something that the Spirit is doing to awaken your heart so that you feel your desire for God? His desire for you, He's romancing you. Let me call up Lindsay and Frank as I pray for us. Heavenly Father, I approach this text with a little bit of fear and trembling. I know that this is the sexual desires which you have given us are problematic for so many of us, maybe for all of us in one way or another. But you have given them to us, at not least to show us that we desire you, that you desire us. I pray that we would see that and feel that today and respond to that. Help us by your Spirit to be attentive to the things that are going on in our lives, by which you are often drawing us to yourself so that we might enjoy you.